Hello and welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell. Back in 2016, Professor Steve Robson, who was then president of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of ONG, and Carla Wilshire, the CEO of the Migrant Council of Australia, formed the Migrant and Refugee Health Partnership. Recently, the partnership published a competency standards framework to help physicians practice in a culturally responsive manner. The chair of the partnership, Dr. Kim Jenkins, and RANSCOG's representative on the partnership, Associate Professor Jackie Boyle, are my special guests today. Why is it important that we are more culturally responsive than we have been in the past? What are we doing wrong if we're not being culturally responsive, in other words?
It's a huge question, but I think you really need to start with Australia being such a cultural and linguistically diverse nation. That's one of the, you know, the richnesses of Australia being such a great place to live. And Australian demographics are changing almost as we speak. And most of our population, I think it's 49% of the population, were either born overseas or have a parent who was born overseas. So what people bring with them when they move to Australia is a whole range of different experiences, life experience and ethnicity and different cultural experiences. And to think that delivering a healthcare system where one size fits all and everyone should fit in with our very sort of Western medicine model of healthcare is really very naive, because you can't deliver or engage people in good healthcare unless you take a holistic view and understand who they are, where they've come from, what their belief systems are, what their previous experiences of healthcare is, and how that colours their health-seeking behaviour. So all those things like people's migration and people's ethnicity and more people's refugee experience is a really important social determinants of health. So they all add to the challenges in providing appropriate and proper and holistic healthcare for the population as a whole.
Has there been a touch of arrogance about the way we've done this, Jackie, do you think?
I don't think it's arrogance. I think that it's just very easy for all of us to view the world from as we see it. It's easy to forget that there are a multiplicity of cultural lenses and our own is just one. So I think it's more that than arrogance. And I think it applies across a whole range of levels. So it's about people actually being able to get to healthcare, and understanding how difficult that may even be for some people, and then having an environment that's welcoming, and then understanding where they're coming from, so why they may not actually follow a recommendation that, you know, they might receive from a healthcare provider.
Yes.
It won't necessarily be that they're being difficult or don't believe you, but that, you know, it might conflict with their values, or they might think that there's a different way to do it and not necessarily feel comfortable in engaging with that conversation, or even have the language skills or health literacy to engage in that. And then there's also, as Kim mentioned, you know, with more people from refugee backgrounds coming, being careful that we don't re-traumatise people when we're providing healthcare.
Is it fair to say that the mix of immigration and migrants and refugees has changed over the last decade or so, so that perhaps we're getting more migrants and refugees from what could be called a traumatic background?
Well, I think that's true, and also from more varied migrant backgrounds. And the other thing that's changing is that we're also getting more health providers who are coming from different backgrounds as well. So, you know, it's not just that we're having Australian-born and trained health providers, but even, you know, it may be that you're Australian-born and trained, but you might, your parents may have a migrant background, or you yourself might. Those things are changing as well, but also the health providers have different cultural lenses themselves. And so, as I said before, it's that we really need to be aware for each of us that we have our own lens, and to be aware of everyone else's. We're just one of many.
Kim, what does a culturally responsive practice look like?
It is embracing all the things that we've mentioned already and considering the needs of the individual and the community from which they've come, and the community of which they're part of now. And it's adapting our own clinical practices to suit the needs of the people we're trying to help and provide healthcare for.
Yep.
One of the ways I like to look at it is, to be a culturally responsive clinician, you really need to be sort of trying to uncover your all your unknown unknowns at the moment. You can be a very good clinician, you can be very competent, but all of us have things that we don't know, we don't know. When you're talking about people from different cultural backgrounds and very culturally diverse people, that's where those unknown unknowns come into play. And that's one of the facts, I think, really underpinning the framework that we produced as the partnership to help people become more culturally responsive in their clinical care. And is helping us all be more self-reflective and considering of what Jackie has described already, our own cultural lenses that we look at healthcare through, and to look at the healthcare of the people that we're trying to help. I think one of the things that's really important in that is for all of us as clinicians, if we're going to be culturally responsive, we have to make sure that the message sent is actually the message received, or the message that we think we're sending to patients in the community is actually the one that they're receiving. And that leads us on to the importance of communication.
Should it be mandatory that GP practices, for example, have an interpreter?
I don't know that we could actually make it mandatory. And if you were to embed an interpreter in a GP's practice, what language and would that person be required to speak? I think it's very good clinical practice to have access to the appropriate interpreter, but to actually have one embedded in the practice may not actually be feasible.
Are there services available that provide help for doctors and physicians providing regular interpretation services?
Oh, yes, there most certainly are. And I think our preference is always, not always, but where possible, is to have an interpreter in the interview with you. But there are very good telephone interpreter services which can be very, very helpful and are easily accessed.
I'm chatting today with Dr. Kim Jenkins and Associate Professor Jackie Boyle from the Migrant and Refugee Health Partnership. You can find the partnership's competency standards framework on their website at culturaldiversityhealth.org. That's all one word, culturaldiversityhealth.org.au. Don't forget you can subscribe to our podcast feed through iTunes or wherever you get your favourite podcasts. They're also available on our website at mja.com.au/podcasts. Back to our chat. Jackie, you're a gynecologist. Are there special things that we should be considering when a migrant or refugee woman comes into our practice?
I think there are many things because there are so many different cultural practices and understandings around pregnancy and after the baby. Part of what we're saying is that it's really important to perhaps if you're working in an area where you see certain groups more often, that you can try and familiarise yourself with what some of those will be. But as Kim said, there's always going to be things that you don't know even about those groups, or there might be someone who comes from a completely different cultural background that you haven't really engaged with before. So it's about being aware that you don't know things and being open and receptive and perhaps inquiring where it's relevant. So yeah, there's definitely things that will impact how women will engage with the service and different tests that you recommend, or for example, talking about emotional well-being and mental health in pregnancy. You certainly can do it, and people have often thought that you can't because of those cultural differences. But I think that part of what we're saying is that if you approach these things in the right way at both a systems and individual level, it can be done in a way that is not threatening or shameful, or and that incorporates the women and the family needs.
Well, let's talk a bit more about the partnership. Kim, tell us about the framework, the competent standards framework that you guys in the partnership have developed, and how you think it can help doctors.
The framework is, I think, one of the key achievements of the partnership in its first couple of years of existence. The official name of the framework is Culturally Responsive Practice, Working with People from Migrant and Refugee Backgrounds. And this has been developed as a competency standards framework for clinicians. This group of people who were a subgroup within the Migrant and Refugee Women's Health Partnership came together to really produce this educational tool to help upskill the profession in the clinical care that they're providing. What we've done is, well, fairly loosely, but not so loosely based on, is the CanMed competencies, educational competencies for medical practice, and the definitions of a medical expert. And the CanMed's work is very well known to medical educators, but it came about in 1996, got revised in 2005, and forms the framework of many of our medical education and training programs now. So what we've got in the framework that we've developed through the partnership is we've taken seven domains, and within each of those seven domains, broken it down into various standards that we think are really important part of becoming a culturally responsive clinician. The actual clinical domains we've got that are clinical experts, which is about us as clinicians needing to have content expertise about the healthcare we provide and understanding the barriers to healthcare, actually understanding medico-legal aspects of not providing culturally responsive healthcare. And then with the other domains as well, as I said, they're loosely derived from the CanMed framework, but particularly adapted to a perspective of being culturally responsive. Like in the clinician as a communicator domain, we need to think about linguistic diversity and cultural differences. And then in the clinician as a collaborator, we need to think about how we work in a culturally responsive way with other healthcare providers and how we work with interpreters who are really important non-clinician, but still part of the healthcare team. The other domains that we've got there are leadership, health advocate, scholar, and professional. And as leaders in a clinical area, we need to actually promote and create culturally responsive environments in which the healthcare can be delivered.
Yes.
And we need to think of those sort of like whole of organisation and systems approaches in which we work and take lead in that when we possibly can. And as health advocates, being a health advocate is a really important clinical competency because we need to be able to speak up and speak out for people who are more vulnerable because of their background or what they've been through before coming to healthcare. Mm-hmm. But we also need to think about healthcare literacy and appropriate healthcare literacy and enhancing healthcare literacy for migrant and refugee populations. Scholar domain is fairly obvious that we need to keep a commitment to our ongoing learning and education in this area. But I think when I was talking about unknown unknowns before, there may be some of our colleagues who don't realise that there is a whole body of stuff that we can learn in this area and important part of our continuing professional development.
There is discussions around preparing some general. The thing is that you can develop these things, but it's also about making it easy for people to undertake some of that professional development. And so, yes, that's definitely, I think, wouldn't you say, Kim, the partnership is looking to develop some tools and educational resources and work with the various bodies to have some of this available as continuing professional development in a way that's easily accessible, and because everyone's busy and you want to make it as easy as possible to access, but also in a meaningful way.
Completely right on that, because there is no point in actually producing this incredible groundbreaking work of this framework if we don't take the next step, which is actually working towards its implementation and aiding key stakeholders to develop a range of practical resources to support its application in clinical and educational settings. But I do know that in cultural responsiveness and this aspect of our training is already in some university courses and in the training courses that and programs that can lead towards fellowship. Capturing the market, so to speak, for continuing medical education and continuing professional development beyond fellowship is actually a whole different ballgame these are different set of resources and different strategies.
Speaking of resources, you've also produced a guide for physicians, haven't you, to accompany the framework?
Yes, we have. This is a guide for working with interpreters. And this is lovely. It's got sections that have been extracted from the framework in it, but it's very specific on that issue of working with interpreters, what you can expect or should expect when working with an interpreter, mm-hmm. what you shouldn't do when working with an interpreter, which I think is probably as an important a list as how to work with an interpreter.
I think it's a fantastic resource that was developed by another working group. I think it's really practical and really useful. When you look at the framework, there's a huge number of groups that have either been involved or endorsed, and I think it's really important to recognise that we did bring in the settlement services as well to contribute.
It's an amazing group of people in the partnership and the organisations they represent, not only so many of the medical colleges, but peak professional bodies from other health groups as well, and community groups and government agencies were there. So the richness of the discussion and the sharing that's gone into this work and is ongoing within the partnership, I think in itself is unique. The fact that so many people have come together and given up their own time, and you're with a group of people who really believe in what we're doing in this partnership, is an absolute privilege to be part of it.
Thank you, Kim. Thanks again, Jackie.
Thanks so much.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.